All right, everybody. Hello and welcome back to In Liberty and Health. Very much so excited for today's show. I've been listening to this guest quite a bit, and him and I have quite a bit of crossover. He's an ex-military guy, also talks a lot about economics and foreign policy, which are two things that are of great interest to me. And he is a former power lifter as well, which is, you know, my jam as well. As you can see, I got my Club NBT. There we go. Club NBT hat on. For the great gym owners that are just a couple minutes away, Justine and Joel. So I very much appreciate them, obviously. But yeah, dollar hegemony in 2025. We're looking at some very, very interesting times going forward. There's a lot going on in the foreign policy aspect. And then obviously with the Federal Reserve and Jerome Powell, and if he's going to, you know, cut or, you know, leave rates where they're at, kind of what's up with that, and then kind of how BRICS and all the other nations are kind of going about the dollar throughout the world. So I think it's going to be a very, very valuable and interesting conversation. But before we get into that, make sure you go to all the links below where you can find my guest, everything he's got going on, everything I've got going on. TigerFitness.com/KyleM to get a little discount whenever you go to Tiger Fitness and shop through them to get all these supplements that make you look all jacked and tan, the stuff that I use every single day. Fox & Sons Coffee, use code Kyle at checkout and deemed fit through the link below to get yourself a little discount and help support first responders as well. SarahM25 should be the code for that. And without further ado, let's get into today's conversation. Where the heck is it?
From a fast break to recovery, Indiana hospitals are here for every Hoosier, regardless of their ability to pay. That's why we're teaming up with legislators on a winning playbook to lower costs and protect access to care across our communities. Because good policy doesn't leave anyone on the sidelines. Learn more at HoosierLifeline.com.
And welcoming to the show today, Tony Arterburn. How you doing, man?
I'm doing fantastic. I love the intro.
Nice, man. Well, I appreciate it. That was one little cut up out of one of my band's tunes, and then you know, some lifting and some other stuff. I tried to make it look as flashy as possible. My old toolbox is in there, but I do have a new one, so I'll have to update that eventually. But why don't you tell my audience who you are and what you do?
Well, again, thanks for having me, and I look forward to our conversation. I am a veteran of three foreign wars, went to the Army in late 99, did my three tours overseas, Kosovo, Afghanistan, and Iraq. I was a paratrooper, military policeman. I learned a lot about history and foreign policy in real time during those tumultuous years, and I got home and started several different businesses along the way. I learned a lot. And I decided around age 38, which was 2018, I was going to go all in on precious metals, gold and silver and coins and other things. Just my reading of history and the timeline that we're on, I believe just subconsciously that there was something terribly wrong with our currency, the dollar, and everything that tracked back to it, the origin of central banking itself. And so I started a company called Wise Wolf Gold and Silver, pretty much in defiance of the norms, or you know what it was prescribed to me as somebody who grew up in the 90s and what the system was. So I decided to do something counter to that, and I believe I was right. I've been on a wild ride through broadcasting and podcasting and my radio show and reaching lots and lots of people. And we have now we're servicing nationwide with Wise Wolf. We have a subscription program, and it's my mission to advise people on what's wrong with fiat currency and the evil in that, and how you can protect yourself against it. So that's pretty much me in a nutshell. Yeah, I left out the powerlifting, though. I mean, you introduced me as I was a world champion powerlifter, but it seems like a long time. Even though I go to the gym every day and I own a gym, I don't compete anymore. I might someday, again, like maybe do a deadlift competition. I did a push pull back in 2023. I did the state championship and I competed as a master and in the master's division, and actually won down in Texas a couple years ago. So,
oh man, that's all good stuff. Yeah, I think the economic stuff tends to get overlooked because the culture war and then foreign policy tends to be for most people a little bit more interesting. Whereas when you're dealing with like objective numbers and kind of how those objective numbers work in the real world, sometimes it could be a little bit dry. But, you know, I did find when I was reading, what the hell was it? Yeah. How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes, which is almost like a kid's book by Peter Schiff. I found that book very, very difficult to put down, but you know, kind of learn about Austrian economics and, you know, kind of Austrian economic theory, I think really helps you understand how and why some things happen. And then also you can kind of predict the way that things are going to look somewhat down the road. Now, not obviously with 100% accuracy, because I think a lot of the Austrians tend to be perma bears, you know, obviously Peter Schiff being one of the big, you know, notable perma bears where the crash is always coming. It's like, well, right, you're right. But, you know, putting a date on that is a little bit more difficult. So what really got you tuned into economics? And do you consider yourself a student of the Austrian school, or, you know, kind of what's more your leanings?
Well, I'm definitely not Keynesian. You know, we're inside of a real-time experiment since 1971. And it was August 15th when Richard Nixon took us off the gold standard. Gold was $35 an ounce. It had been set that way since 1944 at the Bretton Woods Conference, which was basically the end of World War II, or the last year of World War II, and that's where they set up the new economic world order, which was the IMF, the World Bank, and they made the dollar the world's reserve currency, and then again, $35 an ounce for gold. By 71, we had shown the world that we were debasing our currency. We'd taken the silver out of our coinage starting in 1965 and expanded the money supply. The rest of the world took notice. President de Gaulle of France sent his warships over to pick up their gold, the dollars that were being repatriated. So Nixon closed the gold window basically out of necessity, because we had had this expansive money supply, and if it was all cashed in, we were bankrupt. You know, we wouldn't be able to facilitate the taking of gold, you know, at the window for dollars that were repatriated. I will remind your audience too that it was illegal for you to own gold as a U.S. citizen at that time. And it wasn't until Gerald Ford made it legal in 1974, which is a great day for everybody, because you can become your own bank again and have your own gold standard. But a lot has happened since then. If you're a student of history like myself, and I'm just a student of history, I know some real historians. I actually do, you know, shows with them, like Don Jeffries, who wrote Hidden History. So I know real historians. I'm more of an amateur, but I just notice patterns. And if you know that the average lifespan of a currency not backed by anything is about 26 years. So a fiat currency, and the word fiat means by decree, as I'm sure you know, is basically they say so. It's the dollar is worth something because the U.S. government and the central bank says it is. Well, that's all well in theory, and that's what it is. But eventually, on a long enough timeline, paper currency, like the philosopher Voltaire said, always returns to its intrinsic value and state, which is zero, because it's written on paper. So given what we know about things like the deep state and corruption, and how really we've gone off the rails in the last 50 years, so far away from the founding intent of the United States and our founding fathers set up, it just seemed natural to me to get into this type of business. I grew up around entrepreneurs like my father. He you know, was really a force of nature to watch. You know, he built businesses when I was a kid. I just thought that was normal. Like, you had an idea, you write it down, you have a plan, you go build something. I just thought that's what you do. I didn't realize till years later how difficult that was. There's a magic in it, but it's also very, very difficult. I guess it was just really a series of events that led me to what I believe is my calling, which is precious metals and alt media, and taking these complex issues and trying to distill them in a way that, like you mentioned earlier, it gets wonky. A lot of the time, I think they keep you feeling like you don't understand something, like it's so complex that, well, I guess they know what they're talking about. Like if you listen to Jerome Powell, or, you know, if you listen to, you know, any of these people that are associated with the central bank, or Janet Yellen, you know, who was head of the Fed and then the Treasury Secretary. If you listen to them and you're like, okay, well, they must know what they're talking about. Well, not really. I mean, Janet Yellen said, I think a couple of weeks ago that, well, before she left, you know, before the new administration. So I think that now that I'm looking at it, that the COVID stimulus may have had something to do with the inflation. So that was maybe Janet Yellen, ladies and gentlemen. Really, they make things complex. So you know, think that, well, I'll leave it to an expert. It's really not that hard to understand once you realize they have a counterfeit printing press. They increase the money supply. The dollar doesn't gain value and purchasing power in the long term. It may have some short term strengthening or whatever you can see, you know, on the dollar index. But on a long enough timeline, it just continues to go down in purchasing power. And that's because they increase the money supply. And that's what you're seeing when you see gold, like gold just hit another all-time high. But it's not really doing that. Gold is about the same as it was in value as far as what it trades for, or what it could buy 100 years ago. I mean, it could buy about the same amount of land and crude oil and groceries and food and you know, commodities that it did 100 years ago within the margin of error. But the dollar is what's losing. And so that's the magic trick that, you know, the mainstream doesn't talk about, and certainly it isn't taught in schools.
Yeah, for sure. So it's kind of funny when you mentioned going off the gold standard back in 1971, because that's when not just, you know, the distortion of the dollar, but the distortion of a lot of things kind of went all over the place. And, you know, when you start thinking about interest rates and kind of the Austrian insights when it comes to interest rates, you think back to 1971. So that was when we had birth control. And then we also, you know, enabled many, 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 many more people to go into debt through, you know, extending credit lines to them and all this. And then also, you know, you were able to print money ad nauseum. And then that's when we started to get a lot of hyperpalatable foods. Because if you start to look at like caloric consumption from back in the, you know, like late 60s until now, I mean, everything goes up. People are looking for some like specific poison in the food or something like that. It's like, no, it's just the fact that like, as a species, we figured out that like, hey, hyper palatable foods that are very calorically dense, it tastes really good, we like those. And if we don't have to fight or kill for them, we like them all the more. And then over time, we work less and less active jobs. And then, like I said, you look at graphs of all the calories we consume. We eat more fat, we eat more protein, we eat more carbohydrates, because now we're able to produce all this stuff more. But of course, you know, the lowest of all the macronutrients that we eat more of is protein, which is, in my opinion, the most important macronutrient, because that's the one that builds muscle, that's the one that builds bone, that's the one that's going to make you, going to contribute to your longevity the most. So, I mean, you know, it started distorting everything about our lives all the way back then. And then now, you know, back in the late 90s, we cut interest rates down to almost zero. And then from about 2010 up until 2020-ish, interest rates were at 0%. So you're able to borrow money same as cash. So you have to imagine, you know, what does that do to a society, not just, you know, the money, but to a society that thinks that you don't have to delay gratification anymore. I mean, that really changes people's psychology. And I think that's why, you know, this economic stuff is actually a lot more important than people, I think, tend to understand.
Yeah, if you look at the origin to corruption in the United States, the accelerator really gets mashed down when we create the Federal Reserve. And that's when you get a select group of people that control the money supply. Fiat creates a fake world. It creates businesses that shouldn't exist. It rewards those who are close to the central bank instead of rewarding those who are creating the best product or the most profitable. If you notice that this isn't your father's stock market or your grandfather, your grandmother's stock market, it has nothing to do with, like, if you look at Wall Street, profit is not really the goal. It's their connections, it's liquidity, it's debt, the ability to borrow. So we're addicted to debt. I mean, was the bankster J.P. Morgan said that gold is money and everything else is credit? Well, that's not true. Not anymore. Gold is money, but everything else is debt. So we created this debt society and fake news, fake wars, fake politicians with real consequences is what I always say. And that really talks about fiat food. I mean, you mentioned mm-hmm. diet. It bleeds into so much because we work more and more to produce less and less because of the mm-hmm. system. When your currency is losing value, it's hard to get ahead. So you have to get to the next product. You know, you have to put it in an IRA or a 401k. You have to get into the system in order to outpace inflation. They don't tell you that. But if you notice, when we went off the gold standard, 1971, by 1974, then you get the first products like IRAs and 401ks. Mm-hmm. And you start seeing commercials like in advertising get into the zeitgeist where people are saying, well, I should get into the stock market too. This wasn't really part of the American landscape. You know, the American dream was, you know, to own a home and you could save for retirement and all that stuff. But that kind of goes out the window when you can't save your own currency. So, you know, to kind of bleed those things together, you'll see that the when the money isn't real, and you create all these ancillary things that are also fake, they tend to bleed into your food. They bleed into everything. There's that website, WTF happened in 1971, and it talks about not only the economic consequences of fiat currency, but the social consequences, what it does to families, what it does to society itself. It really is truly demonic. When you look at, you know, again, the average person doesn't really see it that way. But if you look at it from a, you know, a 30,000 foot view, and then look at the timelines of the decline of countries or civilizations, it really tracks back to who controls the money supply and do you have sound money and is there trust? Because that's, you know, we have in God we trust on our dollar bills, but is that true? I mean, do you trust that? Is that your God? I think these are the questions that hang over society at large, and whether it's conscious or unconscious, the consequences are real.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of funny you brought up In God We Trust there. I consider myself to be agnostic, but you know, the one thing that I think a lot of atheists and secular people do have to answer for is, okay, well, how do you run a society if you don't have religion? And that's kind of, it goes back to the question of, you know, or you don't tear down a fence unless you understand why it was put up. And I think that's what a lot of people, specifically more secular leaning people, kind of look at that and think, oh, no, you know, we can evolve past religion. It's like, well, I'm not necessarily so sure we can. And, you know, the next question after that is, are you sure we should? And I mean, that's a loaded question in of itself. You know, I understand the arguments for it, but at the same time, you know, you can look around in our society. And like you said, a lot of this stuff, I couldn't think of a better word to say other than demonic, and how, you know, currency manipulation really manipulates most things in our society.
Yeah, it does. I mean, and, you know, this is my wheelhouse. So this is what I see every day when I wake up and I look at headlines. The first thing I start looking at is the prices of commodities. And I look at the financial headlines, and that's going to show you what the geopolitical or political headlines are. They directly correlate. But again, most people don't think to look there. But that's a consequence, really, of the last 100+ years, we've really gotten so far away from the intent of the founding fathers and what the United States was set up to be, which is a republic with, you know, sound money and, you know, free markets and other things that made the country strong in the first place, manufacturing. And, you know, we're in this weird political swing where things got so bad that you see people like, you know, Trump being elected. I never thought that. I ran for Congress, you know, 11 years ago and talked about tariffs. And they looked at me like, well, the voters didn't, but the establishment and the people I was running with were like, what is he even talking about? Like, this is, I remember a very popular conservative radio host who I was on the station with when I started in radio was like, that's lib stuff that you're talking about, jobs and bringing the jobs back and, you know, being against free trade. That sounds like lib stuff. I remember thinking, well, you really don't know history. And I felt like there was going to be a massive populist revolt based off of just where the numbers were going, you know, and eventually, like when you look at what's happening to the United States, where, you know, we're abroad, just not the same entity bogged down, look at our border, look like a pitiful giant. The economy's weakening. The wealth distribution and concentration is the worst it's ever been. Not that there's anything wrong with concentrating wealth. It's just the disparity has gotten out of control. We used to have such a strong middle class. So I see a lot of these things that are happening on the political horizon, and this is a direct correlation to what's wrong with the money. And my problem with politics now that I've, 11 years after I ran for office, is that I like to tell people, well, until you fix this one thing over here, you really can't fix the other things. There's a reason why, Donald Rumsfeld on September 10th, 2001, and that famous press conference, he says we can't track $2.3 trillion at the Pentagon. And of course, the office where they had the accounting office is where, whatever hit the Pentagon, the next day. You do your own, think for yourself on whatever that means to you, but they couldn't track $2.3 trillion. And I know that sounds like today it's kind of quaint because we go $1 trillion in debt every 90 days, but I would add there is something terribly wrong when, it took us, over 200 years to go $1 trillion in debt. I was born the last part of 1979. I was actually born on the day the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And the tail end of 79, we weren't quite at $1 trillion in debt then. But now we do it every 90 days. So that's something that's a metric that you can't escape. It's going to continue to grow and grow because the liabilities are so vast. And we've increased the money. We don't even talk about fiscal responsibility anymore. So at that level, I'm not an alarmist. I just say, look, the system is going to have to reset itself. As a matter of fact, they call it a great reset. I'm not an advocate of that. I think it's terrible. I like sovereignty, and I think we ought to make our own decisions. But the banksters worldwide, whether you're talking about Davos or World Economic Forum, all that stuff, they're looking at a reset to protect themselves. And they know that the system is unsustainable. That's the word that I would use, unsustainable. So all that's going to come to a head, I think, really within this decade. And those who have commodities and understand what money is, as opposed to what currency is, are going to be a lot better off.
Right. I agree. And this kind of gets into another part of the conversation I wanted to have specifically with you today, is one of my more focused topics is like geopolitics surrounding China, because obviously anybody who's really paid attention to like more of the national defense strategy and kind of the way that a lot of the foreign policy has shifted over the last 10 years is mainly focused at fighting great power competition instead of doing terror wars, which, I mean, obviously we're still doing most of the terror wars with the exception of one now. But, basically the national defense strategies ever since 2011 with Hillary Clinton had laid out, well, now we want to pick a fight with China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, which, like, it's ridiculous. But the one thing I say a lot now is that China has now become a lot like what the U.S. used to be, where now their middle class is getting very, very strong. Their purchasing power is going really far. They have a manufacturing base. Vehicles for them are super cheap to purchase. Now, granted, I mean, they're still very, very sick, a very, very poor society overall. But I mean, their standard of living and their GDP year by year is still going up at exponentially a higher rate than the US, where I think the US GDP grows by, like, you would probably know better than me, but by around probably 2% per year. China was there for, anywhere from like 10 to 15% there for, I think, about a decade. And then more recently, it slowed down to about like 5 or 6%. Granted, once again, still lots of issues, but once again, they took a note from our book and said, hey, we're going to become a manufacturing base. And yeah, you could say cheap Chinese crap, but over time it's gotten better and better and better. Whereas we produce nothing over here and, we consume lots. And, much to your point, basically now we send out worthless paper everywhere that's just rapidly losing purchasing power, and we're getting all this stuff from them. So what is your opinion on kind of like the whole BRICS nations? Now, granted, there's no like one currency for BRICS, but kind of like what their overall economic value is versus kind of like the dollar and NATO. So I know it's a very expansive topic, so take as much time as you need.
Well, I think the BRICS is a response to U.S. dollar hegemonic dominance gone awry. And, you know, we have 40 different sanctions on 36 different countries. Last time I checked, we weaponized the dollar. And instead of making it easy and safe and having the trust built into the system, we used it as a weapon because we didn't see anything on the horizon that would supplant our dominance. And that's very arrogant. You can see, you know, the CIA has a term for that. It's called blowback. And that's what BRICS is: Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. And now they, you know, are adding Saudi Arabia and Iran, and even countries like Mexico. Is like 25 different countries in the periphery that are going to be joining BRICS. I don't think they're going to create a competing currency. I think what they're doing is they're trying to create cross-border payment systems that they can use commodities like gold. I've said recently, I think gold has already supplanted the dollar now as the world's reserve currency. It's just that you don't see it that way. I think these other countries do. I'll give you an example. In 2021, the Bank of International Settlements gave gold the designation of tier one status and designation instead of tier three. So that made it, that put it on par with currency. And so at that time, I think gold was way down the list for central bank holdings and reserves. Now it's number two, the dollar being number one, and it just surpassed the euro not too long ago. So I think gold really already is, again, the world's reserve currency. You just don't see it that way because it's not quite set up to where it can be cross-bordered the way that I think BRICS would like outside of the U.S. system. But that's coming. And, you know, you mentioned China. Well, yeah, they took our old playbook. I mean, it worked great. We're the manufacturing marvel of mankind. And we did that because we had tariffs and economic nationalism, and we were strategic and we built things. There's a huge difference between being a productive nation and a consumptive nation. And I think, you know, the metrics for wealth are really on the side of those who produce and can produce. And China, I mean, we gave them the playbook. We gave them that. We gave them resources. Most of my study leads to me to see that all of this is on purpose. You know, if you look at the pawning of America's soul, to quote Pat Buchanan, he wrote a great book back in the 90s called The Great Betrayal. And I read that, as a younger man, about economic nationalism, what tariffs were, what these free trade agreements were all about, the siphoning off of wealth, you know, and jobs and technology from the United States. We just gave China stuff. I mean, you look 90 days after 9/11 to the day, it was December 11th, 2001, we gave China most favored trading status for the United or for the World Trade Organization. And after that, we lost 55,000 factories. One in three manufacturing jobs disappeared. I mean, it was just a total gutting of what was left of the manufacturing base in the United States. And so you can't really blame China. They just, a lot of people right now that's like, China's the enemy. I'm like, well, okay, well, maybe so. But who are the people making the calls? You know, they're, you know, inside the house is really just, you know, putting us on a track for poverty. So I see it as a systematic weakening of what the country was intended to be. And I think ultimately China will slow down. I mean, it's just, you were talking about the GDP growth and economic growth that they had. I don't think they can sustain those numbers over the long haul. And they have like cities that are built out, and they have a real estate crisis. They have a currency crisis because they have fiat currency. But the one thing about China that's not talked about in the mainstream, and that I really do believe from my research, is they have more gold than the United States of America. They started buying off the books at the beginning of the century. They have 60,000 gold mines. They're a net importer, not exporter, of gold. I really do believe that they are this is where I think it's all headed, is that commodities and rare earth minerals and those who control that will control the economic foothold, you know, for the world itself in the future. And the United States is lagging way behind. Now, whether or not, you know, we're definitely on a completely different track than we were 90 days ago. I will say that the second Trump administration doesn't look like the first one, which is surprising. So there may be a lot of economic shifts that I wasn't even expecting. But again, you know, the price of gold today, breaking all-time highs again. And the reason is because of the threat of tariffs. I like tariffs. They can be great. They can also backfire on you real bad. It's a double-edged sword. So what you're seeing right now is like the rise of gold and silver prices. And that's not, I don't think that's surprising given the uncertainty and the nature of where we're headed as far as what role the United States is going to play economically worldwide when these countries have already decided. You got to look at BRICS as 40% of the world's population and growing. I mean, they're adding new countries. They don't want the U.S. system. So de-dollarization is not a conspiracy theory. Literally, it's happening in real time. And I would also add, if you're not staying in, I mean, if you're not like me and just like every day looking at headlines, we lost the petrodollar. And I find that to be fascinating. Like, we literally lost it. We had a 50-year agreement with the Saudis to denominate crude oil exclusively in dollars. And that's what we backed our dollar with. And it used to be a conspiracy. Oh, there's no such thing as the petrodollar. And that's not why we go abroad. So you were called that if you were like, hey, this is we're going over the Middle East because we have to prop up the petrodollar, or we're going to kill Gaddafi because we're going to prop up the petrodollar. And people, oh, that's so conspiracy.
Look at you go, knocking stuff out, letting nothing get in the way. Whatever life throws at you, you throw it back at 97 miles an hour. And if the chips are down, you make more guacamole. Yes, you've got what it takes, because there's no stopping you with you on your side. Everwise believes in the power of you, cheering as you take on the world. Everwise Credit Union. Confidence changes everything. Now go get 'em.
It's not. And we lost it. So what does that mean? And we didn't even put up a fight. We didn't even say, let's have a summit, or what kind of deal can we do? They just let it lapse. So that was a huge signal to me that something is not right at all. Like, we're not even trying to prop up the current system. So what that means for the horizon, I don't know, but I do know that gold and silver and Bitcoin, but the precious metals that, you know, that you can hold in your hand, that's going to be, I think, more and more looked at by everyday people outside of the current financial system. I think it'll gain in popularity more than people think here in the next 5 years.
Yeah. And I think that's a very, very positive development when it comes to, you know, kind of moving more currency towards the metals. And I do agree with the point about China probably is going to start to slow down. And, you know, I hear a lot of people talk about their, you know, population collapse. We'll see. I think there are some signs that point to that. But, you know, it's so hard to know because the world's so unpredictable at this point. But one other thing that you kind of mentioned there briefly was Bitcoin. So, obviously the explosion of crypto over the last like 20 years, perhaps very much so over the last like 5 years, is interesting to say the least. I'm not a Bitcoin believer. I mean, I've interviewed some bigger Bitcoin names and, you know, I'm friends with some people in that realm. I'm not a whole hog buyer in crypto. I think it's an asset, and I think Bitcoin's utility, at least from my perspective, is more so the network that's surrounding it, not necessarily the coin itself. But how do you kind of see crypto in the current world, you know, maybe starting with Bitcoin versus heavy metals, and even if there is like necessarily any kind of conflict there, and kind of, you know, maybe some stuff with like NFTs and meme coins, where you kind of see all this going?
Well, the NFT and meme coins, you can put that in a separate category. I think that the rise in popularity of crypto is a good thing. You can hang a question mark over some of the other technology based on that, or based off the popularity. Meme coins can be very dangerous. I don't you can make some money, but I don't ever advocate them. Now, I'm a Bitcoin maximalist when it comes to crypto. As a matter of fact, my company, we started a separate entity to deal in Bitcoin, Wise Wolf Bitcoin. We've been in the space since 2016. We're actually one of the oldest, if not the oldest, broker in North Texas. We were some of the first Bitcoin ATMs there in my home state. And I learned a lot about Bitcoin. And I would say the decentralized network, the story of Bitcoin makes it unique in the realm of cryptocurrency. Not that other cryptocurrencies aren't valuable, or there's not, you know, a huge upside, and I'm not saying any of that, but I'm sticking with Bitcoin because I think there's something on the horizon with nation states using it, because it's not associated with a company, because it's not associated with a nation state, that there's an opportunity there where, you know, Bitcoiners will talk about game theory, where the countries and central banks will put it on their balance sheet because it is finite, because you can't make more of them, because you can't increase the supply. It's impossible. It's based on the network itself. And so a lot of these entities, I believe, will start putting on their balance sheet. And even Larry Fink from BlackRock said at Davos, he predicted a $700,000 Bitcoin price. He's never done that before. Not that I follow Larry Fink or care what Larry Fink says necessarily, but I think that's something you gather, like if you're just reading the grand chessboard and looking at intelligence. If you take $700,000 Bitcoin at face value, then that means it's on parity and has the market cap of gold. So I thought that was an interesting overture that he made. So I'm watching that very closely. I think these things can go together. A lot of Bitcoiners will say that Bitcoin will demonetize gold and silver. I don't agree with that. I don't even think that's even close to the mark. Gold and silver do something that Bitcoin can't do, and that's exist in the third dimension. They exist. I can hold them in my hand, you know, and I think everybody, and that's the difference. That and that precious metals do something that Bitcoin doesn't do. Also, they're culturally on demand for jewelry, things like that. We use them for dental. We use them for medicine. We use them for technology.
Yeah, I hate to interrupt you, so I apologize, but I just want to add on there while you were mentioning the use of gold and silver. I'm an automotive mechanic by trade, and crash sensors, right? Something that you know, has to respond very fast. So it's basically a diaphragm, and whenever the vehicle experiences, like, you know, a collision, that gold inside that crash sensor, because gold is the most conductive metal, it's very necessary to have something like that that can respond and conduct electricity very fast for safety of people. So much to your point, just wants something I wanted to make
sure. You're absolutely right. So, I mean, there's, you know, the monetary uses for gold are certainly there, but I mean, I read a lot about gold and history and humanity. It's so much a part of our existence, of our story as people. So that's not going away. But I do believe that Bitcoin has a huge role to play, and no one can predict the future. But we live in a fiat world, and the fiat system, especially since 1971, all, you know, other countries followed suit and removed their currencies from the gold and silver standard, Switzerland being the last one in 2002. So there's 52 times more currency on Earth today than when I was born. So that's an increase in the money supply. And when you do that, you decrease the purchasing power and value of it. That's just mathematics. And I'm not an expert. I can't pretend to show you on metrics of why that, you know, how far the fiat's going to go as far as, you know, low in purchasing value. But it's going to continue. And gold and silver are just a hedge against that. I, you know, you look at, I have like five different websites for my companies, and I have two different physical gold and silver locations, and then I have my nationwide business. We never use the word investment anywhere, because I don't really, I'm not an investment advisor. I don't put you in investments. But if you go out today and you earn fiat dollars and you want to have a savings account, well, a great way to do that is to house it in something that is money. You want to take something that's currency and turn it into something that's money. Now, currency and money can be the same thing. But money in and of itself has to do what I just described. It has to have some or other form of value in and of itself to be classified as money. It can't just be, you know, the dollar's not money. It used to be, but the dollar's currency. It can flow like that, and like an electric current. If it stops, it dies. And so you have to really watch that. Once you start to notice that, then you'll never look at it the same. You're like, okay, well, I got it. Just like a game of musical chairs, I have to, you know, make sure that I'm not holding the bag when the music stops. So, like, you want to take your earnings, your energy, and house it into something that is finite. And whether that's Bitcoin or gold or silver, I think that's really the future. You know, you look at this decade, and we're inside the Great Reset decade, where so much has gone on. I mean, you can just go back to 2020, at the beginning of 2020, and our lives are completely different. The economy worldwide is different. Businesses, everything, the birth of AI, all of this stuff it really is going to change the nature of how we look at economics. And I think that the debt explosion worldwide, I think this will have another cascading effect. And that's why more and more you'll see these countries, in every country on earth, in order to solve their problems, they have to increase the money supply. Mm-hmm. That's the trick that they have. And they press the button and, you know, they expand it. So you're a lot better off if you realize that right now metals are cheap compared to what the actual debt is, what the actual debasement of currency is. The true metrics aren't in there. Michael Saylor did a great job in Nashville at the Bitcoin conference by putting up a chart of all the debt, or not the debt, but the assets worldwide in boxes, like these giant boxes. It was this huge chart. I love this presentation that he did. And up in the top left-hand corner, these little dots were the market cap of silver and at $1.4 trillion, and then gold at 16.7, and then Bitcoin at 1.3 or whatever it was at the time. And I remember thinking, wow, that's crazy. You look at hundreds of trillions over here in these boxes, which are like stocks, sovereign wealth funds, currency, and a lot of it isn't real. So there's really not enough real to house all the fake. That's what I took away from it. So I think I'm in the right business. And I think people that understand that will be a lot better off. And I think that's why you see BlackRock taking the Bitcoin ETF and running with it as of January 24. I remember telling my audience at the beginning of 24, I was just like, hey, take a look at what they're doing with these ETFs. The price of Bitcoin is about to go somewhere. And it did. You know, it doubled within 60 days or so, and then continued to do what it's doing. Now we're over, you know, $100,000 Bitcoin. And I think that's really just the beginning, because the answer to a lot of their ills are going to try to find something that can stop the bleeding of what fiat currency has done, and that's continue to lose purchasing power.
Right. So kind of to that point, it seems like the Trump admin, and I definitely agree with you that it seems like Trump 2.0 is a lot different than Trump 1.0, where leading up to Trump's reelection, I was very, very, very critical, and I didn't vote this election because a lot of the signs on the campaign trail, I'm like, it doesn't look like there's going to be any good to come of either one of these options. And I'm glad to say I was wrong in that respect, because, you know, a lot of the executive orders are things that I think people of our persuasion would at least somewhat agree with. But that being said, it does seem kind of like Trump is kind of, I don't want to say concerned, but kind of dipping his toe in the water of the crypto world. And I think that's largely because of some of the people who backed him. So the PayPal mafia guys, you know, your David Sachs, Mark Andreessen, Elon Musk, these kind of guys are kind of getting in his ear and saying like, hey, you know, they're talking about that sovereign wealth fund and, you know, who's it? Mark Andreessen is the crypto czar and stuff like that. What are your thoughts surrounding that and kind of like the, you know, the government's interest in crypto?
Well, it's certainly come a long way. I remember when I started buying Bitcoin for my machines at, you know, $400 a coin, it was, you were pretty much a pariah. You know, like, what are you doing, this weird experimental thing? You know, it needs to be more regulation. We got to stop Bitcoin. It was a war on crypto for a long time. And then it just kind of goes to this phase where you have presidential candidates like RFK Jr. and then Trump at the Nashville conference. And I remember thinking, this is insane. The amount, just the journey that this technology has been on. I think there's an opportunity there for the upper echelon to enrich themselves. That's true. Bitcoin offers that to everybody, not just the lower strata. It's everybody. I mean, if they get behind it. Now, it does threaten the fiat order. So there's an, I just hang a question mark on that. Are they trying to hijack it? Do they want to implode it? You know, I still think the, regardless of the executive orders that Trump's put out or statements, you still have to be very careful of the central bank digital currencies. You got to remember it was Jared Kushner that worked, you know, his son-in-law that pushed the CBDC in the first Trump administration mm-hmm. that was working on the blueprint for that. Biden did an executive order when he took office instructing departments to come up with a plan to implement CBDC. So I'm still looking at, even with the rhetoric and even with the executive, I'm still looking at that. I don't, I'm not going to relax my posture on CBDC. But I do think that, you know, Trump could do something with crypto. He obviously launched that meme coin, before, right. You know, I think day one of taking office, he's a lot. I mean, this is night and day to what the previous administration was, totally anti-crypto and hostile really to it. So we shall see. You know, I try not to, because the water's so murky, you got to stick with fundamentals. But we, you know, like again, try not to be too speculative, because that can get you in real trouble. Like what are the big guys going to do? What's the next move? I just know this. Politically, we don't talk about fiscal restraint anymore. Trump needs a weaker dollar to implement his economic nationalism, if he's going to do that, if he's going to put tariffs up, if he's going to try to restart American manufacturing, because we don't we have to build it, and then our goods have to be able to be exported, so you need a weak dollar. That's going to drive up the prices of metals. You know, the countries that want to repatriate, and there are repatriating precious metals to the United States right now because of the threat of tariffs. It's upending all of the paper markets worldwide. It's really interesting to watch, you know, because a lot of us in the precious metals industry don't believe the current price structure. We think that there's a lot of just papering over supply. And I think if there wasn't the paper and the contracts and you had to actually show your hand, that prices would go up even further. So it's a huge question mark over a lot of it. I just know that at the end of the day, what I, you know, tell my audience is that stick with the fundamentals. We know that we live in a fiat world with fake dollars, fake currencies. So, you know, deal in what is real, what's tangible and what is finite. And right now it's gold, silver, Bitcoin for me. And I think that's, those three things, you know, in tandem, I think are a good hedge against the Great Reset decade.
Yeah, I think that's sound advice. So one other thing I wanted to get your perspective on, because a lot of the people kind of like the more dissident right sphere. So maybe like the first name that comes to mind would be like Tom Luongo, who I've had some interactions with on Twitter. But he's kind of a proponent of, and it sounds like a pretty sound theory, but like that Jerome Powell is this American patriot who is trying to basically say, in so many words, fuck the EU. And, you know, I think it was in the first Trump administration where they basically got the, you know, the dollar really separated from the euro and are now trying to do everything they can by maintaining interest rates where they're at to cut the euro off at the knees. That's kind of a rough idea of what they're kind of talking about. And from my understanding, it does seem like the euro is kind of going down the shitter. So what's your perspective on kind of this whole US euro, you know, Jerome Powell kind of having rates where they're at? What do you kind of think of that whole situation?
I just saw that the European Central Bank, they're cutting rates. They have to increase their money supply. Their economy is not doing well. They have a demographic problem in Europe. They have a dying native-born population. There's not a lot of energy there. And I think there's going to be a lot of more calls for nationalism inside those regions and countries. I think that's the order of the day. It's something called ethno-nationalism, which is a phenomenon of history that I don't think that the planners can escape. As a matter of fact, the trend of history right now is going against the New World Order. It's going against centralization. As a matter of fact, we're decentralizing ever since the Protestant Reformation with the American Revolution and so on and so forth and technology. But they try to, you know, bend the river of time with either, you know, false flags or wars or whatever, you know, and draconian measures to get us to all in one centralized system. But people, you know, humanity itself is trending away from it. So, I wouldn't be betting on these entities like the Eurozone or anything like that. I mean, and it might be just WWE with Jerome Powell, because who does he work for? This is the same people, the people that own the central banks in Europe and the Bank of England and that's owned the Federal Reserve are the same folks. So it's probably maybe some infighting or who controls what. But that's beside the point. I think that's it's all like, you know, the old maxim is like, you know, back in the medieval times, it was like, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? You know, and like, that's kind of a ridiculous question. You know, like, what does that even mean? How do you quantify that? I think that's what we're looking at in our current economic reality, where there's not a lot of real actual wealth. We're looking to central banks to define economic health or where we are or growth. And that is, they're the last entity. They should only be housing sound money. That they should only be the repositories of our money supply and not the, you know, arbiters of what the economy does. And so, or how well the economy is doing. So I think you're going to see a lot more decentralized things like the rise of cryptocurrency. I think you'll see more populist movements worldwide to have a sound economic system. You look at what people are doing in places like India and China. They're buying gold. They're buying because that's where their wealth is. That's what they see it as wealth. And there's something in human nature that does that, from my reading of history. So I think we're just that old Chinese curse. You know, may you live in interesting times. It's hard to know exactly where we're headed. But you, like I said, you keep going back to the fundamentals. Like, we know that this won't last. Like, you know, whatever. Economic system we're in, because it's not based on anything real. It's just an illusion. And we have to deal and work inside that illusion, but don't fool yourself.
To the point of everything being an illusion, one thing that I find myself frustrated with whenever I hear people talking about economics, they always cite the stock market as a proxy for the health of an economy. And it's like, okay, well, or I would always see these copy-pasted statuses of people bragging about how great the economy was under Trump. They're like, well, interest rates were much lower. Like, well, you know, how do you think that kind of got to us? You know, how do you think that kind of worked out for us in the long run? Clearly not very good. And then of course they never say, oh, well, the stock market hit record highs under Biden too. Does that mean the economy was doing good? No.
Well, Venezuela had a massive stock market rally while their currency was dying. I often point to that. It's like, it's, you know, it's the best of times, it's the worst of times. And you have like a record highs on the market, but you know, I'm, you know, cutting up old pieces of jewelry to trade at the local vendor, you know, so there can be some gold. You can have look at the wealth disparity, and that's what you have to look at with the United States. I mean, yeah, Wall Street can be doing really well, but Main Street's not. You know, since 1973, we haven't ran a trade surplus in this country. That's how we built the United States, was trade. And you mentioned China earlier, and I forgot to include, you know, if you look at the amount of trade deficits that we ran, that money has to go somewhere. It doesn't go into the ether. You know, it's like, okay, we brought in, you know, 600 billion more than we exported. Okay, where's the 600 billion go? Well, it goes somewhere else. That's wealth to somebody else. And that's mostly places like China and the Asian sector and wherever these companies moved after NAFTA, like Mexico and other places, or some oligarch somewhere. It doesn't go to us, the American people. And certainly there's just this huge disparity that's happened. So, you know, when you look at all the metrics and all the things that we've lost, purchasing power, manufacturing, all of that, you add it up and you realize that, you know, politically, I don't think it's hard for people to articulate that. It's like, well, I know we lost something. What was it that we lost? You know, we used to be something that, you know, totally different than we are today. There's going to be a renaissance, I think, in especially in the West and general, and you're going to start seeing, you know, people wanting to return to something more normal, you know, like, okay, I want to be able to have a living wage job. I want to be able to do that. I want to be able to support a family. I want to be able to own a home. And the problem with owning a home now is an entire generation gets priced out because of inflation. It's caused that, you know, $50,000 house to be worth $500,000. Like, how do you even get into that when wages haven't increased? So all of that really goes back to not having a real dollar.
Yeah,
not having
I agree.
The stability of that.
Of course, of course. Yeah. And I was kind of talking to some friends on Twitter about kind of like the economic stuff. And, you know, I feel for the people younger than me. So I just turned 30 back in November. And I've owned my house in April. It'll be 8 years that I've been paying my mortgage. And, you know, thank God, Southwestern Pennsylvania, real estate's dirt cheap here. So, I mean, I got a pretty nice house for less than $100,000. I'm looking at kids that are 10 years younger than me. And I got all the sympathy in the world for them, because it's like, you guys are going to have it tough. Like, I think you guys are going to pull through, because I believe in, you know, the younger generation and their, you know, desire to do well. I know it's popular to shit on the younger generations, but I think there's going to be some, if they want it, they'll get it. That being said, it's not going to be easy. For me, it wasn't easy. And for them, it's going to be even harder because, you know, much like we've kind of talked throughout this whole conversation, your dollar goes a lot less further than it, you know, used to. And, you know, housing prices are so driven up because, you know, a lot of people do look at their houses as some form of like commodity or something that they can make money on because, oh, I'll reverse, you know, mortgage my house or something like that. I'll take out equity loan or something because, you know, my house appreciated by this much, rather than looking at like, no, this is somewhere like I live and something that I need. This isn't like a money-making venture. This is, you know, a necessity. And I think, you know, we really lost our way when we started to look at a house as something that we can make money on, you know, without moving out or selling it, right? Like, that's kind of the way that I think a lot of like boomers start to look at their house. And I think that's kind of why, you know, a lot of people ran up a lot of debt and started to have, you know, all these funky loans out in the economy.
Well, then it basically creates giant bubbles because it's not really worth that. And every time you take out a loan, every time you swipe a credit card, that's currency creation. I know that's hard to wrap your head around, but that, I mean, it's hard for me. It's like, okay, so that's new currency? Yeah, it's new currency. They just create it. Used to, you had something called fractional reserve banking, which, you know, you had so much deposits, and then the banks could legally loan against that, and that's what fractional reserve was. They could loan out, you know, more than what their assets were, or just a fraction of the assets. Now that's off the table. It's literally, we get a home loan, it's new currency. It's new currency enters the system. Eventually, you just have a bubble. And, you know, it's like the Rothschild said at the beginning of the 19th century, you know, you end up buying when there's blood in the streets. And, you know, they were able to manipulate markets. And that's what a lot of where they got most of their wealth, you know, was through subterfuge and skullduggery and spycraft and other things. You know, like when Wellington defeated Napoleon and they sent their messenger back to sell the stocks rapidly, and they thought that that Wellington had lost, and no, they were just wanting everybody to sell and drive the markets to nothing, so they can buy it all up. So you have to watch things like that too. Those at the top know, and they're running the simulations, and unfortunately we don't have the resources to keep up with that, except you have history, and you can look at history and look at the metrics. And when you know that, you know, a fiat system ultimately will collapse on its own weight, there'll be a lot of opportunities too. You just have to stay, you know, as vigilant as you can, you know, getting into the last years of this decade as they go push towards the Great Reset, that you're able to take advantage of that. I think there will be massive bubbles, and maybe we can afford houses again. Unfortunately, a lot of people will get hurt on the way down to some sort of equilibrium. But I, you know, I just, you know, I can't forecast prices or anything like that, but I think that the true value of precious metals will shine through in the next 5 to 10 years. We're not seeing them now. I'm assuming we're seeing a glimmer of it, but not true valuations. I'll remind your audience that the high for silver, I was just born, it was 1980, and it was $52.50. $52.50 in 1980 is about $300 today in purchasing power. And we've not reached that all time. We're not nowhere close to that on silver. So there's something terribly wrong with valuations of actual monetary metals based off currency. Mm-hmm. And I think that will be something that also corrects itself. JP Morgan Chase is the largest holder of silver in the world. Mm-hmm. And they were convicted of suppressing the silver market. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't wrap. They're like, wait, they own the most silver and they wanted the price to go down? Yes. Mm-hmm. And they've kept it that way for a while. And, you know, right now my business is interesting because people are liquidating and somebody's buying. So, like, you know, a lot of the big purchases I see, actually I'm buying and I'm selling to the trading floor wholesalers. And the business has changed a little bit. People are getting into the markets and other things, but ultimately prices are going up, so someone's buying. Those are institutions, ladies and gentlemen. Those are countries. They're buying. Russia just made silver, put it on their strategic assets, which is a huge move. The last country that really held that way was China, and back in the 19th century and early 20th century. So a lot of interesting things on the economic horizon, but change being the one thing that you can count on.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Tony, I want to be respectful of your time, and I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, so let's please do a follow-up. But until then, why don't you let my audience know and everybody out there in the ether know where they can find you, support you, and all that good stuff.
Well, I appreciate that. And yeah, anytime you'd like to talk again, just, you know, I'd love doing shows and having, this is always a topic that I'm easy to, you can wake me up at 3 a.m. when you talk gold and silver and markets. So it's not a problem for me. You can find my website is mylastname.gold, arterburn.gold. There you'll find my shows and links to my business. My business is Wise Wolf Gold and Silver. And I would add that we did something that really nobody else has. I have a subscription program that, you know, the big gold and silver companies, they don't care that you have $50 or $500 or $5,000. I do. And so I created a subscription program as low as $50 a month. I send you precious metals with a detailed invoice. And we have about 1,400 members all over the country. You can find that on my website. There's a little tab that says Join Wolfpack. And that's what the basis of my national business is, where we ship nationwide. But we also are the first broker in America to accept Bitcoin as cash. So if you've got Bitcoin and you want to buy precious metals, you can buy it from me at no fee. And nobody else does that. So you can go direct through any of my websites for Wise Wolf and or my arterburn.gold. And I also do some shows. You can check out my podcast, and hopefully you like it. Join it and give me a review.
Absolutely. Well, I highly recommend everybody do that. I know everything I've listened to from Mutual Friends shows, your appearance on there, and then your own show, I've thoroughly enjoyed. So everybody, make sure you go check out his stuff. And until next time, everybody, thank you so much for listening, and take care. We'll end her there.
Look at you go, knocking stuff out, letting nothing get in the way. Whatever life throws at you, you throw it back at 97 miles an hour. And if the chips are down, you make more guacamole. Yes, you've got what it takes. Because there's no stopping you with you on your side. Everwise believes in the power of you, cheering as you take on the world. Everwise Credit Union. Confidence changes everything. Now go get 'em.